Before we head to the episode, please be aware it may contain content that some people find distressing. It is also unsuitable for anybody under the age of 13. Hello and welcome to episode 4 of It's Murder Up North. Thank you to all my new listeners and followers. If you love the podcast, please leave a review wherever you listen. I've decided not to do individual shoutouts on this episode. I've had so many wonderful messages that it would take a whole episode to mention you all. So to ensure no one is left out, I say a huge thank you to everyone. I am always open to case recommendations, and I am happy to hear your thoughts on the cases I cover. Today's episode is a listener suggestion. Thank you, David, on Twitter. The way I choose cases is currently based on if they have an emotional or geographical significance to me. Today's episode is based in the city of Wakefield, where I currently live. So let's get on with the episode. Colin sat on his auntie and uncle's sofa. It had been 2 weeks since he had been whisked away from his parents' house after seeing his dad being driven away in the back of a police car. The light from the TV flickered as the chimes of Big Ben announced the start of the 10 o'clock news. The tired 6-year-old stared at the screen as an image appeared on the last chime of the bell. It was the face of his sister. Before he had an opportunity to process what he was seeing, his uncle swiftly picked him up and carried him off to bed. 2 weeks prior, on the 9th of October 1965, 6-year-old Colin Frost had been playing in the street with his friends when he saw a police car pull up outside his house. He watched as two officers knocked on the door. Seeing that his parents had not answered, the little boy rushed over to let them in. His mother was downstairs watching TV, and his father was asleep upstairs after working a night shift on the railway. One of the officers approached his mother. The little boy could not hear the conversation, but he watched as his mother crumpled into the arms of the police officer. The second officer hurried Colin out of the room and asked him to go and wake his father and advise him that Elsie had been involved in an accident. Upon hearing the news, Arthur Frost rushed downstairs, and before the bewildered boy knew what was happening, his father was leaving in the back of a police car. Following this, Colin was taken from the family home, and over the last couple of weeks he had found himself being moved around from different relatives, unaware of what was going on at home. It was only when Colin returned to school that he learned the painful truth that they had been protecting him from. He was told by another pupil at school that not only was his older sister dead, but she had been murdered. This was not how his family wanted him to find out about the death of his 14-year-old sister. The family had faced a dilemma. How do you tell a 6-year-old his sister had been murdered? Colin's older sister, Elsie Frost, was born on the 7th of February 1951. She was the middle child, with an older sister Anne and a younger brother Colin. They lived in the Lupsett area of Wakefield, a city that lies 9 miles away from the city of Leeds. In the 1960s, Wakefield had a population of roughly 60,000 people. It was seen as a good place to raise a family, with parks, lakes and a bustling city centre. Lupsett was a housing estate built after the First World War. It sits to the south of the city, not far from the River Calder, and a series of lagoons which were used for swimming and sailing. It was on Saturday, the 9th of October 1965, that Elsie was due to volunteer at the sailing club down at one of the lagoons. She dressed in a skirt and a white blouse, put on her best shoes and wore her bright red anorak. At around 1:30 p.m. she left the house to meet her friend at the Horbury Lagoon Sailing Club. When Elsie arrived, she discovered her friend was not there, but as she had volunteered to teach some sea rangers at the club, she decided to stay. At approximately 3:30, Elsie went out on a boat with the sailing school master, John Blackburn. He would later state that after she had got into difficulties navigating a boat, he decided to take her out for further instruction. He recalled that the pair had returned to the dock at 3:55, and after helping tidy away the boat, Elsie headed home. She was followed by some boys from the club and another teacher. John was the last to leave the lagoon at about 4:20. Elsie walked with the other members of the club until they came to a fork in the path where they parted ways. It's been speculated that the other route would have taken Elsie down the muddy canal towpath, and as she didn't want to soil her best shoes, she opted to take another route alone. It was a bright but chilly afternoon, and there were a number of people around the area. Thomas Brown was out with his two young children, walking their dog. They headed towards a tunnel that passed underneath the railway line, when his attention was drawn to something red lying at the foot of a set of steps that ascended a steep embankment. The steps were known locally as the ABC steps, due to there being 26 of them. As Thomas got closer, he realised it was a young girl. She appeared to have collapsed while trying to climb the steps. She lay in an awkward position. Her left arm lay on the second step, her head resting against it, and her right arm seemed outstretched towards the next step. Thomas asked the girl what was wrong, but he got no response. He tried to lift her, but he found it difficult, so he dragged her to a nearby patch of grass. It was only when he saw the pool of blood that the girl had been lying in that he realised how serious the situation was. Elsie Frost had been viciously attacked on a Saturday afternoon in broad daylight on a track used by lots of people locally. The teenage girl's injuries consisted of stab wounds to her back, head, chest, and her right hand, which suggests she had tried to defend herself. Within just 10 minutes of leaving the boat club, Elsie Frost had been murdered. 14-year-old Elsie was described as a quiet and shy girl. She had a maternal nature. At school, she was a model pupil who had just been elected to be head girl, a very prestigious accolade. She wanted to be a teacher, and her family believed that she would have been wonderful in the role. Her younger brother Colin recalls Elsie teaching him how to tie his shoelaces. He explained that she was so patient and her instructions were so clear that he got it on his first attempt. And now, every time he ties his shoelaces, it brings back memories of his sister whose life was taken over 50 years ago. The city of Wakefield had never experienced a case like this, and as news spread of the horrific murder, the community were appalled. The site where Elsie was killed was a much-loved spot. It served as a great place for children to play. People would walk along the riverbank, fish in its swift flowing currents. The lagoons were popular, especially in the summer, where people would go to have picnics and children would enjoy the water. It was also a favourite spot to see the steam trains as they trundled over the tunnel across which Elsie had been found. The tranquility of this much-loved area would forever be tainted with the evil that occurred that Saturday in 1965. The severity of the case was reflected in the scale of the ensuing investigation. 92 detectives from the Metropolitan Police and forces in Bradford, Leeds, Wakefield and Dewsbury were brought in to investigate. They took over 400 statements and questioned over 120 people. It was clear that the police were eager to catch the killer. And as the weeks turned to months, they issued statements emphasising the importance of staying safe. These were particularly aimed at teenage girls, who advised not to go out unaccompanied. It was clear that the police thought there was a chance the killer could strike again. 3 months after the murder, the investigation was not making much ground. They could not determine why someone would want to kill this well-loved young girl. She had no enemies, she hadn't been linked to anyone romantically, and there was no evidence of a robbery. It just added to the senseless nature of this crime. A coroner's inquest was held in January 1966, during which the statements of 42 witnesses were heard by a jury and the presiding coroner. Those called to testify included Elsie's father, Arthur Frost, the sailing schoolmaster, John Blackburn, and a local man, Ian Spencer. Ian Spencer was a 33-year-old railway worker who was married and had a young son. He admitted to being at the lagoons that day. However, he was home by 3:30. His wife, mother-in-law, and a family friend could corroborate this. Spencer drew suspicion on himself when he commented on the fact he had lost a knife that day. And he was reported to say, "It'd be just my luck that that would be the murder weapon." These suspicions were intensified when three other witnesses placed Ian Spencer at the scene after 3:30. And it was revealed that he also possessed an extensive knife collection. In a move that would be unimaginable today, the coroner delivered his findings. He concluded that Elsie had suffered an unlawful death. She had been murdered. He then went on to state that given the evidence, Ian Spencer was the murderer. What must have been going through Ian Spencer's mind? When he left home that morning, he was just going to give testimony as a witness. By the end of the coroner's inquest, he was being held in a prison cell awaiting trial. His case was heard at the magistrate's court, and the defence argued that there was no evidence to tie Ian Spencer to the crime. There was a lack of blood on the defendant's clothing. The knife he claimed he had lost, he found in the pocket of his overalls. And this knife, along with the ones in his collection, were willingly handed to the police, and they were ruled out as the murder weapon. Ian Spencer also had an alibi, and the people who could have corroborated that alibi were never called by the coroner to testify. On the strength of the defence's arguments, the magistrate's court threw the case out and found Ian innocent. However, Ian did not walk free. The coroner's court had the power to overrule the decision of the magistrate's court, and so Ian was returned to prison to await trial at the assizes court, which held more power than the coroner's court. Ian spent 8.5 weeks in prison before his case was heard at the assizes. It was here that the judge advised the jury to find the defendant innocent, as there was no evidence to link Spencer to the crime. Finally, Ian Spencer was a free man, but his mind would forever be imprisoned. For over 50 years, Ian Spencer kept a daily log of his movements, where he went, at what time, and who he saw. He did this every day, haunted by the fact that three witnesses had falsely stated he had been near the lagoons that day. So the police were back at square one. So what did they do? The simple answer is nothing. All investigations into Elsie's death ceased after Spencer's trial in 1966. It took the efforts of Elsie's brother Colin and sister Anne to fight for the case to be reinvestigated. In 2014, in a desperate attempt to get their story heard, they contacted the BBC's IPM show, and through them the case was brought back into the limelight. And thanks to this 10-part series, I was able to gain so much of the information I can tell you today. Elsie's case had sat dormant for nearly 50 years, and the siblings were left with so many unanswered questions. Why had the files been sealed? Why did the investigation stop in 1966? And the most important one, who killed Elsie Frost? Many conspiracies have swirled around what people believe to be the secrecy surrounding Elsie's case. The fact it remained untouched for so long and the case files were sealed, on the surface, appeared suspicious. Who were the police protecting? What information were they hiding from the public? The case stalled in 1966, simply because the police had no further leads to follow. Until new information came to light, they had hit a dead end. As for the files, there was no secret conspiracy. The files are sealed because they pertain to an active murder inquiry, and as such contain vital information that could help prosecute a suspect. They are also unavailable to the public to access, as they contain sensitive details, such as crime scene and autopsy photos, that could cause distress to the family and affect the dignity of the victim should they be shared on social media sites. Many of these decisions have been made because of the Freedom of Information Act. Originally, a file could be unsealed after 75 years. However, this can now be extended if the information in the file could affect any person related to the case that are still alive and may be negatively impacted by the disclosure. A cold case review of Elsie's murder was conducted in 2014, and a new investigation was conducted in 2015. These efforts were hampered by the loss of key documents over time. It is believed that some evidence may have been lost in an arson attack on the forensic archive labs. But the most unbelievable thing for current investigators on the case is the fact that key evidence was destroyed just 6 months after Elsie's death. Arthur Frost was offered his daughter's clothing. He declined and signed a document that stated the items could be destroyed. It astounds me that first of all they would ask a grieving father if he would like the clothes his daughter was murdered in. But the fact they went on to destroy the clothing that could have contained vital evidence suggests that the police were short-sighted at the time and did not see the significance of the items. After all, they did not have the forensic tools we now possess. Sadly, Detective Chief Inspector Paul Fountain, who led the cold case investigation in 2014, told the BBC programme IPM that this was not a one-off occurrence, and evidence in other cases had suffered the same fate. The question still remains, who killed Elsie Frost? For many years, it was speculated that Elsie had unintentionally interrupted two men having intercourse. As this was illegal at the time, she was killed, so she would not tell. This was further corroborated by the apparent story of a nurse who claimed to have heard a patient who was under the influence of drugs claim that he was at the lagoons with another man when Elsie walked past. Fearing she would expose them, the patient claimed his companion chased after the teenage girl and stabbed her. This story is purely speculation. Neither the nurse or the patient have approached the police, so it must be seen as hearsay until proven otherwise. In 2018, there was new activity surrounding the case. Reports began to surface that the police had arrested someone in regards to the murder. He was named as 80-year-old Peter Pickering. Police were preparing a case to prosecute him. However, he died of a heart attack before he could be brought to trial. So where does this leave Elsie's case? In November 2019, an inquest into the case was conducted. New information came to light. One damning revelation was that Scotland Yard had sent a file regarding Peter Pickering to West Yorkshire Police, just 4 days after Elsie's murder. However, the file was returned, stating that the force were unable to locate Pickering and asked to be advised when he was apprehended. It's strongly suspected that he was responsible for the murder. However, with the death of Peter Pickering, died any chance of justice for Elsie and her family. Police in 1965 did do surveillance on Pickering's home address. They resided outside the property for 2 whole weeks, but after only seeing his mother coming and going, they ceased the operation. Tragically, this allowed him to kill again. Join me next week to learn more about the Beast of Whomwell. Thank you for listening to episode 4 of It's Murder Up North. Please show your support by liking and subscribing, and don't forget to leave some reviews to help the podcast grow. You can follow It's Murder Up North on Facebook and Twitter, and check out the YouTube channel. Join me next time for episode 5, The Beast of Whomwell. So in the meantime, keep an eye on those shadows.